Nagley hits up her Pentagon guy. She calls in whatever markers she's holding. He organizes some kind of audit out in Colorado. If anything is missing up there, then it's game over for us. But if everything is still present and correct and accounted for, then it's game on. Nagley checked her watch. Just after 6 in the west, just after 9 in the east, the Pentagon would have been humming for an hour. She took out her phone and dialed. Chapter 58. Nagley's buddy wasn't dumb. He insisted on calling back from outside the building, and not on his own cell phone either. And he was smart enough to realize that any payphone within a mile radius of the Pentagon would be continuously monitored. So there was a whole hour's delay while he got himself across the river and halfway across town to a phone on a wall outside a bodega on New York Avenue. Then the fun began. Nagley told him what she wanted. He gave her all kinds of reasons why it was impossible. She started calling in her markers, one by one. The guy owed her a lot of heavy-duty favors. That was clear. Reacher felt a certain amount of sympathy for him. If your balls were in a vice, better that it wasn't Nagley's hand on the lever. The guy caved and agreed within 10 minutes. Then it became a logistical discussion. How should the job be done? By whom? What should be considered proof positive? Nagley suggested Army CID should roll up unannounced and match the books with physical inventory. Her guy agreed and asked for a week. Nagley gave him 4 hours. Reacher spent the 4 hours asleep. Once the plan was settled and the decision was made, he relaxed to the point where he couldn't keep his eyes open. He went back to his room and lay down on the bed. A maid came in after an hour. He sent her away again and went back to sleep. Next thing he knew, Dixon was at his door. She told him that Nagley was waiting in the lounge with news. Nagley's news was neither good nor bad. It was somewhere in between. New Age had no physical plant in Colorado, just an office. They contracted out their raw missile production to one of the established aerospace manufacturers in Denver. That manufacturer had a number of little wing assemblies available for inspection. An Army CID officer had seen them all and counted them all, and his final tally was precisely what the books said it should be. Everything was present, correct, and accounted for. No problem. Except that exactly 650 of the units were currently stored in a separate, secure warehouse, crated up and awaiting transport to a facility in Nevada, where they were due to be decommissioned and destroyed. Why? O'Donnell asked. Current production is specified as Mark II, Nagley said. They're junking what's left of the Mark I's. Which just happens to be exactly 650 units. You got it. What's the difference? The Mark II's have a small fluorescent arrow painted on them to make loading easier in the dark. That's all. You got it. It's a scam. Of course it's a scam. It's a way of making the paperwork look legal when Mahmoud's people drive them through the factory gate. Reacher nodded. A gate guard would fight to the death to prevent the unauthorized removal of ordnance. But if he saw paperwork with a reason on it, he would pass the load through with a smile and a cheery wave. Even if the reason was the absence of a small painted arrow on something that cost more than he made in a year. Reacher had seen the Pentagon junk stuff for less. He asked, how do the electronics packs fit on?
In, Nagley said, not on. There's an access port in the side. You unscrew it and plug the pack in. Then there's some testing and calibration.
Could I do it?
I doubt it. You'd need training. In the field, it's going to be a specialist's job.
So Mahmoud couldn't do it either, or his people.
We have to assume they've got a guy, They wouldn't spend $65 million without being shown how to put the things together.
Can we nix that transport order?
Not without raising an alarm, which would be the same thing as dropping the dime.
You still got any markers left on your guy?
A couple.
Tell him to have someone call you the second those units roll out.
And until then?
Until then, Mahmoud doesn't have the missiles. Until then, we have complete freedom of action.
Chapter 59.
At that instant, it became a race against time. When the warehouse door opened in Colorado, a door of a different kind would slam shut in L.A. But there was still a lot to prepare. There was still a lot to discover, including exact locations. Clearly, New Age's glass cube in East L.A. wasn't the center of anything. For one thing, there was no helicopter there. And they needed exact identities. They needed to know who knew and who flew.
I want them all, Reacher said.
Including the Dragon Lady?
Nagley asked. Starting with the Dragon Lady. She lied to me. They needed equipment, clothing, communications, and alternative vehicles. And training, Nagley thought.
We're old, we're slow, and we're rusty, she said. We're a million miles from what we used to be.
Well, not too bad, O'Donnell said.
Time was when you'd have put a double tap through that guy's eyes, she said. Not a lucky low shot to his leg.
They sat in the lounge like four out-of-towners discussing how to spend their day. As far as ordnance went, they had two hardballers and the Daewoo DP-51 from Vegas. 13 rounds each for the hardballers, 11 for the Daewoo. Not nearly good enough. O'Donnell and Dixon and Nagley had personal cell phones registered to their real names and real addresses, and Reacher had nothing. Not nearly good enough. They had a Hertz Ford 500 rented in Dixon's real name and the captured Chrysler. Not nearly good enough. O'Donnell was in a $1,000 suit from his East Coast tailor, and Nagley and Dixon had jeans, jackets, and evening wear. Not nearly good enough. Nagley swore that budget was not a problem, but that didn't help with the time factor. They needed four untraceable pay-as-you-go cell phones, four anonymous cars, and work clothes. That was a day's shopping right there. Then they needed guns and ammunition. Best case, a free choice for each of them and a lot of spare rounds. Worst case, one more make-do handgun and a lot of spare rounds. That was another day's shopping. Like most cities, L.A. had a thriving black market in untraceable weapons, but it would take time to penetrate. 2 days of material preparation, maybe 2 days of surveillance and research.
We don't have time to train, Reacher said.
Azhari Mahmoud had time for a leisurely lunch. He took it in a sidewalk cafe in Laguna Beach. He was staying in a rented townhouse a short walk away. Safe enough. The lease was legitimate. The development had a large, transient population. It wasn't unusual to see U-Haul trucks parked overnight. Mahmoud's was two streets away in a lot, locked up and empty. It wouldn't be empty for long. His contacts at New Age had insisted that Little Wing must not be used inside the United States. He had readily agreed. He had said he planned to use the weapon in Kashmir on the border against the Indian Air Force. He had lied, of course. He had been amazed that they had taken him for a Pakistani. He had been amazed that they cared what his intentions were. Maybe they were patriotic. Or maybe they had relatives who flew a lot, domestically. But it had been politic to go along, to get along. Hence the temporary inconvenience of the shipping container and the dockside location. But there was an easy remedy. Southern California was full of day laborers.
Mahmoud calculated that loading the U-Haul would take them a little less than 30 minutes. They figured the clothes and the phones would be easy. Any mall would have what they needed. Guns were guns, either obtainable in time or not. Dixon wanted a Glock 19. Nagley's hands were bigger, so she nominated a Glock 17. O'Donnell was a Beretta guy, by choice. Reacher didn't care. He wasn't planning on shooting anybody. He was planning on using his bare hands. But he said he would take a Glock, or a Sig, or a Beretta, or an H&K, or anything that used 9mm parabellums. That way all four of them would be using the same ammunition. More efficient. Cars were more difficult still. It was hard to find a truly anonymous car. In the end, O'Donnell suggested that the best bet would be rice rockets, small Japanese sedans and coupes tricked out with loud, big-bore mufflers and lowered suspensions and cotton-reel tires and blue headlights and black windows. 3- or 4-year-old examples would be cheap, and they were everywhere on the street, close to invisible in Southern California. And O'Donnell figured they were a very effective disguise, psychologically. They were so closely identified in the public mind with Latino gangbangers that nobody would think a white ex-soldier was inside behind the darkened glass. They gave the cars and the phones priority over the guns. That way, 2 or 3 of them could start the surveillance, at least. And if they were going to Radio Shack for the phones, they might as well duck into the Gap or a jeans store for clothes, too. After that, wired and blending in, they could separate and hit used car lots until they found the wheels they needed. All of which required cash money. Lots of it. Which required a visit to a teller's window by Nagley. Reacher drove her in the captured Chrysler and waited outside a bank in Beverly Hills. 15 minutes later, she came out with $50,000 in a brown sandwich bag. 90 minutes later, they had clothes and phones. The phones were straightforward, talk-only, pay-as-you-go cells. No camera function, no games, no calculators. They bought car chargers and earpieces to go with them. The clothes were soft, gray denim shirts and pants, and black canvas windbreakers, bought from an off-brand store on Santa Monica Boulevard. 2 sets each for O'Donnell and Dixon and Nagley, and 1 set for Reacher, plus gloves and watch caps and boots from a hiking store on Melrose. They changed at the motel and spent 10 minutes in the lounge, storing one another's numbers in their phones and learning how to set up conference calls. Then they headed north and west to Van Nuys Boulevard looking for cars. All cities had at least one strip full of auto dealers, and L.A. had more than one. L.A. had many. But O'Donnell had heard that Van Nuys, north of the Ventura Freeway, was the best of them all. And he had heard right. It was a cornucopia. Unlimited choice, new or pre-owned. Cheap or expensive, no awkward questions. 4 hours after they arrived, most of Nagley's automotive budget was gone, and they owned 4 used Hondas. 2 slammed Civics and 2 slammed Preludes, 2 silver and 2 white. All 4 were beat up and well on the way to being worn out, but they started and stopped and steered, and no one would give them a second glance. Including the captured Chrysler, they had 5 cars to ferry back to Sunset, but only 4 drivers, so they had to make 2 trips. Then they took a Honda each and battled out to East L.A. for a swing past New Age's Glass Cube. But traffic was slow, and it was late in the day when they got there. The place was locked up and deserted. Nothing to see. They planned via a 4-way mobile conference call, and went out for dinner in Pasadena. They found a burger bar on a busy street and sat at a table for 4, 2 opposite 2, shoulder to shoulder in their new gray denims. A uniform of sorts. Nobody admitted it, but Reacher knew they all felt good, focused, energized, in motion, up against high stakes. They talked about the past. Escapades, capers, scandals, outrages.